morning, everybody. So as Tony said, I'm Philippe Charpentier from CERN, and I'm the computing project leader of the LHCb experiment, that is this little stack of stones there. And so a disclaimer, like what Gunther said, is the examples I will take are slightly biased towards another experiment from his. Which is one of the smallest, but I know it better than the others, so I will give you examples coming from LHCb. So let me first explain you what I'm going to talk about and what I'm not going to talk about. These lectures are not meant at teaching you how to use the grid, because in fact nobody knows how to use the grid really. So I will try more to give you a flavor of what grid computing is in the framework of the LHC. And so I hope that at the end you will more or less understand what it is about. But then if you are in one of the LHC experiments, and except the theorists, all of you are in an LHC experiment, then you have to go and see how the grid is used in your experiment, because it varies very much from one experiment to the other. And as far as where we can go today, I've put a slide somewhere in the middle, expecting I will reach that point today, but we'll see. And I would like it to be interactive. Don't hesitate to interrupt me and to ask questions. If you want me to give more explanations, I will try and give explanations if possible. So today, what I would like to concentrate on is why grid computing and what it is. And then to give a few more informations about what we call the data management system. While tomorrow I will more concentrate on what we call the workload management system and how to use the grid for production activities, for user analysis, and to show a few slides on what is currently being achieved, and then an outlook of what could happen next on the grid computing. I didn't start my timer here. So it starts just now. So I know I have 5 minutes. Okay, fine. So basically, why do we use grid computing? It's just because it was realized, in fact, long after the LHC had been launched and the experiments had been decided on, that well, after all, these experiments will collect a lot of data. There will be 40 million crossings per second, and out of that, probably the trigger can bring that down to something like 200 hertz. But each event might be as large as 1 to 1.5 megabyte. And then if you put all these numbers together, this means CMS or Atlas will collect something like 200 to 300 megabytes per second, and assuming a canonical running year of the LHC of 10 to the 7 seconds, then you put all the numbers and you can realize that we are talking about petabytes of data that we have to manipulate, and we have to reconstruct the events to then analyze the events, and this is a very challenging thing. So at that time, I remind you, that was more than 10 years ago, people were using, for the LEP experiments, we were talking about gigabytes. I remember at the beginning of LEP, someone told me, if ever CERN is able to provide us with 50 gigabytes of disk per experiment, then we are safe. 50 gigabytes of disk, yes. And something like a handful of CPUs of the time that are less powerful than what is on the PDA now. And that was it. So there was a quantum jump from what we used to use in the LEP times and what we should use there. So 1.5 petabytes per experiment per year. That's true for Atlas and CMS. It's a bit less for LHCb because the recording rate is only 70 megabytes per second, but it's a quarter of that. And for Alice, it's less when they are running in proton-proton collisions. But as soon as they start running in ion-ion collisions, an event is a gigabyte or something like that. So it's huge. So Then people started to consider also the time it takes to reconstruct the events. It takes something like 10 to 20 seconds per event, real clock time, on a reasonable CPU of today. This means that one needs to have permanently, if one wants to reconstruct those events, almost at the same speed it is they are taken. This means we require 2,000 to 4,000 processes running permanently for each of the experiments, just for the reconstruction of the real data that is coming out. For simulation, here we are talking about something, I think for Atlas is something like 15 minutes. Well, the Atlas people know better than I do. I heard something like 15 minutes per event, which requires, then for the simulation, requires tens of thousands of processes to get the Monte Carlo done. The analysis is very fast, but here it's totally unpredictable. What are we going to do? What are users going to do for analysis? Are they going to submit many, many, many jobs? And how is it scheduled? Some people will launch jobs before the weekend, before they leave on vacation, and then they will come back and want to see the results. So it's what we call the chaotic usage of the computing, and this is also extremely frightening. So the usual estimate is that for the analysis, the amount of CPU that is required is of the same order as for the reconstruction. Why simulation is always dominating because of this GN4 that is taking a lot of time to simulate the showers and the calorimeters essentially. So in an ideal world, what should we have? Well, the ideal thing would be that each experiment has a huge computing center somewhere above the experiment, somewhere in the fields, in the page X. You put a big computing center, you put there a few hundred thousand processes, you connect that, you put a few tens of petabytes of storage, of disk storage, because you don't want to have things on tape and recording from tape, so you put tens of petabytes of disk. You put some mass storage with tapes behind, just to for resilience in case your disk is broken. And then you put a very high performance network connecting all the collaborating institutes from all around the world to this huge computing center, and off we go. That works fine. Well, there is a small caveat here is there is a big risk is that if this computing center fails, then everything stops. And the second one is who is going to pay to build this computing center? Everybody is ready to pay a bit, but not to put money to something that will be installed somewhere where they don't have control. So unfortunately, the ideal world, which was more or less what was happening at the time of the fixed target experiments or the lab experiments, this is something that that probably is not affordable. Although now we see that that Google and Google, Yahoo, Amazon, they have computing centers of this size somewhere in the cornfields in the US and even in Europe. So maybe we should have done that. So the alternative that was considered at the beginning of this millennium was distributed computing. In fact, in the old days, I mean, the end of the previous century, people were already doing distributed computing. So the way we were doing distributed computing at the lab times was that the data was reconstructed at CERN. They were copied onto some small cartridges that were taken out of the robot at CERN. They were put in a box. The box was put in a plane. The plane was sent to somewhere, Rutherford Lab or Edinburgh or Lyon in France and so on. Then they were put back in a robot there, and then the local people were doing analysis locally. It was distributed, but it was not very fancy and not very performant, although I think that the highest bandwidth network you could think of is an airplane. Much faster than any transatlantic line. But of course, you transfer a lot of data at once, and you don't have a continuous stream, of course. So the idea of distributed computing is to have several large computing centers distributed all around the world and provided by whoever is willing to provide computing resources, and to replicate your data sets at various locations in order to avoid single points of failure and to give multiple possibilities for people to analyze their data here or there or somewhere else. Of course, you need high performance networks still to interconnect all these sites together.
And also what is very important is that the user, it should be a seamless system. So the user should just submit a job and doesn't care where it's going to run. I don't care whether my data is in Taiwan or it's here next door in St. Andrews or in Edinburgh. I just want my job to be running, analyzing my data, and that's it, and getting back the result. So you need a transparent job submission, hiding all the complexity of what is behind. And this is what was coming up in the early 2000s. So in fact, in 99, I think the first ideas came up. And then at the CHEP conference in 2000 in Padova, there was a launching of the idea of using the grid paradigm for LHC computing. And since then, as Tony said, then there were some constructions around that in order to organize a bit and the LHC computing, and this is what I'm going to try and explain. What had happened a bit earlier is a study on, there was a study made, but before thinking about the grid, made on how we could do analysis of such huge amounts of data, and that was called the Monarch project. It was an R&D project at CERN, led by Harvey Newman from Caltech, and the result of this was a model that was describing the hierarchical system of computing centers called tiers. And of course, there is one of these centers is different from the others. This is the place where the data is produced. So this was called tier zero. And it happens to be CERN in the case of CERN, but it could have been Fermilab in case of the Fermilab Collider experiments. But okay, in this case, it is CERN, where the real data are produced. And then you have a set of large centers called tier ones that are supposed to really be the place where most of the storage is going to take place. And these are robust and well-defined computing centers. And then at the level below, there are the tier twos, and the tier twos are smaller computing centers. And the idea in Monarch is to have also tier threes that could be departmental computing centers, something just for a group of 5-10 people in a lab. And then they were even giving a name of tier four to something that is your own computing center, which is your laptop or your desktop. So there were five levels of tiers defined. But in the Monarch model, these tiers were not only a hierarchy of size, but it was also a data flow along this hierarchy. Data is produced at CERN, then it is transferred to the tier ones where it is reconstructed. It's also reconstructed at CERN, possibly, but it's also exported to the tier ones. And then the reconstructed data is exported to the tier twos, and then eventually to tier threes and tier fours, and the analysis takes place in the leaves of this stream. The sites, the tier zeros and tier ones are essentially here as a support for this huge cloud of tier twos, tier threes, on which people are doing analysis. So the data was flowing along these lines, and it was the definition of these tiers was really a functional description according to these data flow. So this is what we had when things started at the beginning of the 2000. When the LHC computing grid was set up, and because there was this Monarch thing, the LHC computing grid was set up in 2002, I think. Well, it had several names, but it ended up being called LCG, the LHC computing grid, and it uses the same terminology as Monarch, but in a slightly different way. Tier zero is still tier zero; it is still CERN. That's the same thing. The tier ones, and then the tiers are defined by their level of service, the quality of service, and also quantitatively the service they are providing. So just after the tier zero, there are tier ones. These are large capacity. The definition of tier ones are sites that have a large capacity of mass storage, which means, in current terms, tapes or whatever is a resilient medium that you can rely on. Where to keep your data. Currently, these are tapes. And these tier ones are usually, there is one per major country or one per countries. So there are not many of these tier ones. they are supposed to have a very high bandwidth between the tier 0 and the tier 1s and between the tier 1s themselves in order to be able to exchange rapidly the data. Then there are the tier 2s that are giving a lower level of service, slightly lower level of service, which means that they can be down from time to time, and also, very importantly, they don't have mass storage, so they just have disk storage. And they are getting their data from the tier 1s, or they are sending data to the tier 1s, but they are not keeping data on tape at the tier 2s. And then the tier 3s and tier 4s were not considered in the LCG because it is considered that this is outside the grid. So it's we still have in mind, some people are talking about tier 3s, so these are just computing, just clusters of computers which are not predefined. So this is the definition of the tiers in the LCG. Notice that there is not necessarily a hierarchical dependency between these tiers, although it is assumed that the tier 1s are giving some advice and some help to some tier 2s, but it's not necessarily that there is a data flow that goes to the tier 1s, and then necessarily the data from these tier 1s go to a certain set of tier 2s. Although, for example, Atlas is using this model because they have what they call clouds, and the cloud is one tier 1 and a set of tier 2s that are associated in a cloud, and they have many clouds. But this is not mandatory in there. You can very well have something completely transparent where all the tier 2s are interconnected with all the tier 1s. So there is no concept of hierarchy and of data flow, and there is no concept either of what is happening on these sites. It's just a quality of service. It doesn't say analysis has to happen on tier 2 or whatever. Analysis can happen anywhere, and reconstruction can happen anywhere, and simulation can happen anywhere. So then on top of this, then the experiments were considering how to do their own computing, and each of the experiments has his own constraints and also his own political constraints and its own ideas. So the four experiments, Alice, Atlas, CMS, and LHCb, were designing their computing model between 2002 and 2005, and they were finally presented in 2005. And here in the computing models, what you have to define is what is the functionality you want from your computing system, and how do you map this functionality to the sites, to the tiers that are part of the computing grid. So what is the functionality that the experiments are expecting? It is the same for the four experiments. There is first real data collection and recording. This is obvious. This happens at the tier 0. There's no other place where you can do that. But then you have to export this data in order to have some replication for security in case, I don't know, an aircraft is missing the Geneva airport and is falling on the CERN computing center. You don't want to lose your data, because this is the most important, not that the people will be killed. Use your data, and this is very expensive, because if you count the price of a terabyte of real data by dividing the cost of the LHC by even the petabytes that we are going to record, each terabyte of data has a very, very high cost. So it's very precious. So it has to be replicated in quasi real time in order not to have problems in case the data could be lost somewhere. Then there is the real data reconstruction or re-reconstruction, because you know that we have to reprocess several times the data. After months or after years, the data has to still be there, still have to be able to process them, to reconstruct the data a few years later. Then there is a Monte Carlo simulation and reconstruction. There is no input there, so you don't need any input, but you are producing some output and you are consuming a lot of resources, as I said before, sometimes 15 minutes per event. And then there is the analysis, where people have to analyze large data sets with usually quite fast programs, but they have to run on many, many, many events. And also in analysis, there is this part on large data sets, but there is also what we call the end user analysis, which is which is at the very end. Once you have reconstructed, you have identified your particles, you have reconstructed your jets, you have obtained your Higgs candidates or your favorite CP violation candidates in LHCb or whatever, and then you have to make plots in order to make your publications and so on. This is not part of the grid computing proper, because this is something that you can do today on your laptop, on your desktop. But this has to be considered, because this is quite important to be able to do that. You have to be able to transfer the data to your computer and so on and so forth. So the mapping of this functionality to the tiers may differ from experiment to experiment. And the next slide shows just the usual picture of the tier 0 at the center, the tier 1s kind of orbit around it, and then all the tier 2s all around. And then what do we do with all these sites? The total of all this is about 120, something like this. So the four experiments have, as I said, different usage of the tiers. And in fact, ALICE Atlas and CMS have slightly different concepts, but globally speaking, it looks rather similar. So for all experiments, tier 0 is central data recording, and tier 1 is the mass storage for the data, because by definition, this is a place where there is mass storage. And Atlas and CMS do the first event reconstruction, the calibration, and some part of the analysis at CERN, on the tier 0. For ALICE as well, but except for the ion-ion collisions in ALICE, the CERN computing center would not be sufficient, and they do that on the tier ones, a bit like LHCb is doing. I'll explain later. And then the re-reconstruction during the shutdowns or a few years later, this is happening at the tier ones. And then, a bit like in the MONARCH model, for ALICE, ATLAS, and CMS, the analysis is essentially done on the tier 2s, as well as the simulation. And because the tier 2s only have disk storage, then what they call the AODs, the analysis object data, is produced at the tier 1s, it's stored at the tier 1 on mass storage, and then it's distributed to the tier 2s for analysis. And the simulation is running also on the tier 2s and then sending their data back to the tier 1s for storage. And then the result of this is again distributed to the tier 2s for the analysis of the simulation. In LHCb it's slightly different because of several constraints. One of them is that the recording rate of LHCb is much higher than for the others. In terms of megabytes per second, it is about a quarter, but in terms of number of events per second, it's about 10 times more than Atlas. And then the reconstruction requirements is higher than for Atlas, although the experiment is smaller. And for that reason, it was decided to reconstruct the events not only at CERN, but also at the tier ones, even for the first pass reconstruction. So the events are stored at CERN, they are distributed to the tier 1s, and then they are processed on the tier 0 and the tier 1s, even for the first pass reconstruction. The simulation, as for everybody, is running at the tier 2s, but the big difference is that LHCb have decided that the analysis would not run on the tier 2s, but would run at CERN and on the tier 1s. And this is essentially for practical reasons. As we may discuss later, one of the major issues with doing analysis is this chaotic access to data on disk. And this is very delicate, and due to the fact that it's a small experiment with less manpower than the others, it was thought, maybe we are wrong, but it was thought that it would be safer to do analysis at tier 1s because we are less demanding for the analysis than the others. So we need less sites and we will have better support from tier 1s, which we'll see is not necessarily always the case. So now a few words about the abstraction of the grid. So coming back to this ideal world of a worldwide computing center, in fact, the grid should look like a worldwide computing center, but of course not located at a single place, completely distributed. So the main requirements, as I already said before, is you need some storage everywhere, you need to store your data, and you need to transfer this data. So this is what we call data management, and this is what I'm going to describe later later today. And of course, one has to submit jobs in order to process this data, to analyze this data, or for, in the case of simulation, just to produce some data. And this is the job submission and the control and the monitoring, etc. This is what we call workflow management. Sorry, workload management. Sorry, it's a typo. Workload management. Please correct me your handouts. So, and in order to run all this behind, you need a global infrastructure. So the infrastructure is not only a computing center with some cooling, some powering, some computers there, some networks, but also an organization. You also need to support the users. You need to be able to know exactly what is happening when a site is up, when a site is down, what happens. And so you need a global organization, including problem reporting, problem solving. Somebody discovers a problem that somebody else might experience later, so better say it first and then distribute the information. So all this has to be set up. And the functionality of the grid is usually decomposed in terms of what we call services. So the grid is providing services to the experiments. And we will go through these services. So the idea to decompose the grid into services came in the early days, but was formalized a bit in 2003, I think, in an exercise that we did together, the four experiments that we called ARDA, and that was standing at the time for a roadmap to data analysis, no, for distributed analysis. And then it became a realization of distributed analysis, and now it doesn't exist anymore. And so this is a picture that was produced in 2003 and describing some of these services. Of course, it's not completely exhaustive, but there are many, many things that have to happen. You first, not at the center, but really important in the picture is this human being on the left top corner, which is the place where somebody has to interact with the system. So you need a user interface to be able to do some actions, to transfer data, to submit jobs. And then you need, as I said, a workflow management, a data management system that are the central services, and these have to handle for the workflow management some computing resources, some CPUs, which we call computing elements. Data management has to handle some storage, which we have conveniently called storage elements, but they have to exchange information with each other because you don't want to submit a job to Edinburgh if the data is in Fermilab. So you need the data to be here. So either you submit the job to Edinburgh and the job says, "Oh, I need the data, I need it from Fermilab, I copied it," or you say, "Oh, the data is only in Fermilab, so I submit the job to Fermilab." So you have some freedom to choose, but you need some interaction between these services. Of course, if you want to run a job, you need the package, the software that is running. You need it to be distributed. So you need this is the point 10 here. You need a package manager to be able to distribute all these packages, all these pieces of software. In order to know where the data is, you need a file catalog. In order to know what this data represents, whether this is Higgs candidates or whether this is simulation of last year or whatever, you need a metadata catalog that the user can query. You can say, "I want to analyze the data of 2010, of June 2010, that was reconstructed in January 2011, for example." So these kind of queries, they have to be placed, and then this returns a data set, and this data set has to be turned into a set of files. So there is a metadata catalog. Of course, in order for all these to talk to each other, you need the point one, the top, an information service. Each of these services needs to know where the others are. Where are they located? What is their address? What is the address they have to use to communicate with each other, and what is the capacity that they are providing, how much storage is provided at this place, how much computing power is at the given site. All this has to be stored somewhere such that the whole system can collaborate and knows where to find the services. And then you have a lot of auxiliary services that should, for example, keep the history of what has happened. So the job provenance, for each job you have to know exactly where it went through. In case you find a problem in the output, you can always go back and say, oh, but this job was running on this machine and this machine was badly configured or whatever. You need also some auditing to verify, to be sure that people are not doing silly things and are not submitting jobs that are hammering the White House mailbox such that Mr. Obama can't read his mail every day. And of course, you need also some accounting, because you need to be able to say at the end of the year, Mr. So-and-so, you have used so much resources and you use too much, and something like this. And very importantly as well, you need to be able to tell people you are authorized or you're not authorized. And this is the part concerning security, authentication, authorization. So just a few words on the grid security, because it's something that we tend to neglect. And personally, I hate security, because I hate when I go to an airport to be checked, but I'm very happy when I'm in an airplane to be safe. And it's the same thing on the grid. I hate having to renew my certificate, but I feel safer that people have certificates and can't destroy the work that is done by my collaborators. So it's really very important to be able to identify who is doing what. And because it is a worldwide system, you can't have just your username as you have on your laptop or as you could have on your home computing cluster, just with your name, and then you assume that everywhere in the world your username and your password, the same password you ever use, is the same everywhere. That would not work. So the idea was to use, instead of using a login by username password, was to use so-called certificates. And what is used is certificates of the type X509. So if you try to set up the wireless in this room, you will learn what is an X509 certificate, because you need it. And this is a kind. This is your grid pass. This is your passport. And in order to get it, you have to have a real passport with your name, your affiliation, everything. You have to be registered somewhere in the database, and then you are given by an authority, that is the authority in your country, in principle. Although you can also obtain it from CERN, you get your passport. And your passport is given with a validity of 1 year, exactly, to the minute. Once you have got your certificate, it has to be approved by the certification authority, and then it has to be approved also by your experiment. I forgot to mention it here, but of course, your passport, you have to say what is your nationality, kind of. Not your real nationality, but I'm in Atlas, or I'm in an HCB, so that you can't just use the resources of the other friends. And then, of course, one could use these certificates to identify ourselves everywhere in the world. The problem being then that the certificate would fly on the network, and that somebody smart with a good sniffer would pick up your certificate, and then we use your passport. It's just as if you would put your real passport in an envelope to send it somewhere. That's not very safe. So what we use instead of certificates is we use what we call proxies. A proxy is just the same information as in the certificate, but it has an expiration time. It's valid only for a very limited duration, a couple of hours, could be a couple of days maximum. Of course, it depends on the duration of what you want to do. If you want to run a job that will last 2 days, you better have a certificate that lasts 2 days. Otherwise, at the end, the certificate will have expired. It's a bit like your visa. It's a visa with limited time. And then, of course, if someone can steal your proxy, he can do something on your behalf, but it cannot harm very long. So the proxy will be destroyed, will be invalidated at a certain time, and then they will stop harming. So a few things were added to that. There is a possibility to add the notion of groups of roles to these proxies. When you create the proxy, you could say, because a single human being can have several hats. I am the responsible for the computing of LHCb, so I can behave as a responsible for the computing, but I'm also a physicist, so I should be able to behave as a normal physicist. And I don't want to have all the privileges my position is giving me in order to run my analysis. That would not be fair for the others, and I might even do some stupid things, like destroying, have the right to destroy the files of everybody, but I should not use that. It's not malicious, but it's that by a mistake I could do something wrong. So you need for a specific action, you need to really know exactly which hat you are wearing. So there is this possibility. This is called the VOMS extensions. So you add, you specify, now I'm behaving as a manager, or I'm behaving as a normal user, or I'm behaving like a software manager or whatever. And so your certificate, once you have it, it's your passport. You should never, ever give it to anybody. You should not even give a proxy, although many people give that proxy to somebody else for temporary time. I even know some people who give permanently their proxy. So this was about security. Now, a few words about the organization of the LHC computing grid. And so as I said before, what is important is to have all these computing centers interconnected with networks, and of course it has to be organized. Right now there are several organizations depending on the region of the Earth. In Europe there is something called EGE, that stands for Enabling Grids for E-Science. Although in the Nordic countries there is another organization called Nordgrid that is a sister organization that's slightly independent from EGE. In the US there is something called OSG, the Open Science Grid. In Asia there is something called Asia Grid, I think. As simple as that. So there are several organizations, and some are using some pieces of software, some are using some other pieces of software. There is kind of independence at this level. And then of course comes the problem of interoperability, because you want to be able to transfer data from one grid to another. So this complicates even a bit the organization. So in order to federate all this, starting in 2002, there was this at the beginning called LHC Computing Grid that was set up, and now it's called Worldwide LHC Computing Grid. So there is W, it's hard to see, but there is a great W behind RCG there, that federates all the infrastructure and tries to coordinate all these various grids. And then, of course, inside there are the so-called virtual organizations. So a virtual organization is just a community of people that are working together, and they share kind of, if you take the analogy of the passport, it's kind of nationality, if you want. So for the LHC, there is one VO per experiment. It was a choice. We could have decided that I don't know, the Higgs search of ATLAS is one VO, and that the SUSY search of ATLAS is another VO. That would not be very practical, but it could have been done. But for the time being, there is one VO per experiment, so it's a community. And then of course there are a lot of funding agencies that are contributing to all this. I didn't pretend to list all the funding agencies on the site. I'm just putting some logos there. Essentially, from the tier ones of the LCG and the super organizations of EGE, Open Science Grid, Nordgrid, and then there are all these organizations in Europe, in the US, for running the infrastructure. So maybe I can make a little pause here. Do you have any question on this part? Then I will go into more detail on data management description. Alles klar? Very good. Unless you are all sleeping. I know you are sleeping. So data management. A bit more detail on how this is done. Well, as I said, as I shown in the picture of the services, at the basis of the data management are the storage elements. So a storage element is just a piece of hardware and software that is managing the storage at a given site. So this consists of disk servers, possibly if it's a tier one, some mass storage. And mass storage are tape robots, so tape drives with some robots that are picking up the tape and putting it in the tape drive, putting it back, etc. for the tier 0 and tier 1, and these servers of different sizes depending on the size of the site. So this is really the basic hardware element, but there is some software to run that, of course. Then above that, there are what we call the catalogs. So the first one is the file catalog. And the role of the file catalog is to be able to say, this file, there is a copy of this file at this place and at that place and at that other place, because the file may exist at different places at the same time. So in order to know where the data is, you need this catalog. It also allows you to say what are the files that are available for the community. Then, as I said also before, there is this metadata catalog that users may query to get a data set that they are interested in. They would then look up in the file catalog, get a list of files, and then they would analyze this list of files. To complement all that, you need to distribute the data, so you need some file transfer services. And when you run your job, you have to be able to access this data, so you need to read the data that is on disk. So you need some libraries to access this data. And all this is globally called the data management services. So the storage elements first, to start from the bottom. It was decided from the beginning that the sites would have a complete freedom of choice on the technology they use for their storage element. The main reason for that was that many sites were already existing before and they had already chosen a technology. Why did they choose this technology and others chose that technology? Don't ask me why, I just don't know. Because they are as good or as bad as each other. And some sites have decided in the meantime to change technology. At the very same time, there was one site that was moving from the Castor technology to the dcache technology, and another site was moving from dcache to Castor. And when we asked why, they all said, oh, because Castor is not good. And the other one said, oh, because dcache is not good. So, but probably they are as bad as each other. And so far in the LCG, we have four technologies for the storage element. I start by the CERN one that is called Castor. That stands, I think, for CERN, by something storage. And so Castor is handling disk storage and mass storage. Everything is integrated into Castor. So Castor is handling everything, the tape management and the disk management. It is developed at CERN and it's currently used at CERN, at Rutherford Lab, at CNAF in Italy, and at ASGC, not AGSC, ASGC in Taiwan. So it's used by four sites. And the most popular mass storage element that has a mass storage is called dcache. This is developed jointly by DAISY and Fermilab. It's essentially, as the name indicates, it's a disk caching system. And it can use multiple mass storage behind. So you have a file system, and then you can plug in different types of mass storage. It could be commercial mass storage. It could be homemade mass storage. So depending on the site, they use also a different backend for the tape storage. It's used at most of the other tier ones, and it's used at some. It's used as well at some tier twos, but in this case, they just used the disk. It's not the disk cache because the tier twos don't have mass storage. But some tier twos still use dcache. Although most tier twos have moved to something else that is called DPM, that stands for Disk Pool Manager, that was developed at CERN, and this is a pure disk management system. So it allows to manipulate the disks behind, but not directly with a mounted file system. It's more than just a mounted file system. You have much more in the DPM, for example. In case a file is very hot, everybody wants to read that file. The system automatically puts the file on several servers, such that not everybody is having the same physical disk. So it really improves the reliability and the performance of the system. And this is used at most tier twos. And last but not least, there is another one called Storm. that has been developed in Italy, and for that reason it is used essentially in Italy at the CNAF Tier 1 center. And at CNAF they use Storm for the disk, and behind they use Castor for the tape. So you see, people can even use some mixture. So it's rather complex there, and of course each of those technologies has a different way to interact, has a different way of handling the files, different way of handling the tapes, different ways of cleaning the disk cache, and so on and so forth. So it's very, very complicated. And of course, we at the level of the experiments, we don't want to have to rewrite everything every time somebody changes technology. So with these four types of SEs, and I only put three here because otherwise, okay, the slide would be too small. It was realized very quickly that it could be a pain, although some people do use the specific commands for each of the storages. But there was a proposal in 2005 or 6 to use an abstraction layer that had already been discussed and thought of long before, completely outside the context of the LCG. But it was discussed in the context of high energy physics in Berkeley, I think. It was to have what we call an interface layer between all these systems to present the user with a single abstraction of the storage. And for that reason, it's called Storage Resource Manager, SRM. And the idea is rather simple. Imagine that these are three different storages that are presenting different interfaces. So these are the interfaces. They look quite different. And if you want to plug in your system on top of that, if you have this shape, then it doesn't fit on that one. So what SRM does is it just provides software layer that has the proper interface to the actual storage. But in front of it, each of the SRM implementations presents exactly the same interface. So this is the way to solve the famous problem of the electric plugs in UK and in Switzerland that don't look similar. Then you put everything back to the same interface. And then when you as a user, you come with your user code, then your user code is happily adapting to Castor, to Dcache, or to DPM. So this is the role of SRM. Although it is not always very simple, because very often what happens, what you want to see on the interface is not really something that can be implemented with the actual interface of the storage. And the story started in February 2006, and it's not yet complete. The interface is standard, but the interpretation of it is not always standard. Nevertheless, it's providing most of the functionality we are asking for. So it's providing this unified interface. And it has, we have asked at that time to implement another notion, which is that we don't want to see at the site, at the storage element, we don't want to see a flat structure that all the files look alike and are in the same bulk of disk, because you don't want necessarily to mix the real data with the reconstructed data with the user files on the same disk servers, because the cost of this data and also the access pattern of this data is completely different. So in 2006, it was decided to introduce the notion of what we call spaces, also called service classes, to prevent interferences between the various type of usage of the storage. So these service classes, they define the accessibility and the latency of the data. I take a simple example. The raw data is usually written once, and it's read once in a while, maybe once a year, twice a year. So for this data, you don't need it to be resident on disk permanently, but you want something that is absolutely safe when you take the data in the experiment and you want to write it onto tape. You don't want to be told, oh, sorry, no space available. What happens? I stop the experiment, what do I do? So you want something completely reliable and robust, but you don't need to have things permanently on disk. While for the AODs, for the analysis data, a lot of people are going to access these AODs. So you need these AODs to be permanently on disk, and the disk have to have very fast access for local usage, also very fast access for transfer. So the latency to get access to the files for reconstructing raw data, you don't mind if you have to wait 2 hours before the data comes on disk, and then you can reconstruct the data. Anyway, you have a lot of data to reconstruct, and if you have put that in a pipe, you effectively never wait. So there are three main classes that have been defined, and they are labeled with as follows. So T stands for tape and D stands for disk. And there is, so T1, D0 means data that is stored on tape but not permanently on disk, like for the raw data, for example, something that you don't need to access very often. There is tape 1, disk 1. This is data that is permanently on disk, but there is a backup on tape because this is precious. For example, the AODs, one copy of the AODs has to be of such a form because you, in case a disk is broken, you don't want to lose your data. So there is always one site where the data is on disk but also put on tape. And then for the other replications of these data sets, you don't really care, because if you lose it, you can easily transfer it from somewhere where it is really sure that you can get it. And then you have T0, D1, which means there is no tape behind. So it could be a tier 2, for example, but it could be also on a tier 1 or tier 0. And you don't have a copy to tape, but you have a permanent copy to disk. And of course, one can extend these notions, and we are currently discussing, for example, for the raw data, to have the possibility at CERN to have a T2 D0, which would mean that then the file would be replicated to two different tapes, and of course, if possible, two tapes in different buildings, because the experience proves that in Taiwan they had a fire that was stopping them for months. And if you get a fire in your tape silo, even if you have a copy somewhere else, this is really quite annoying. And there could be also D2. For example, tape 0, disk 2, which would mean that there are two copies on disk. And like this, if one disk server is brought down, then you always have a second copy. So we can extend this notion, and then it is a discussion with the sites to provide these service classes. In order to control who can write, who can read — everybody can read, but who can write into these spaces — there is a system in SRM of access control lists that is supposed to be put in place, but as not everybody has the same understanding, it's still ongoing work. Where the standard interface is that there is a standard way to express the name of a file in this SRM world, which is the same thing as what you use in a web browser. It's a URL, but it's not a regular URL starting with HTTP column, because here it's not HTTP, it's SRM, so it starts with SRM column, and it's a storage URL, so we call it an SURL. And it has the same form as any URL, so there is SRM as a protocol, and then the name of a machine, an endpoint, the machine will contact, and there is a port number that can be omitted sometimes. Then there is a path of the file that you want to access. And it's split in two. There is a base path, that the base path being VO dependent, usually it's /atlas, /HCB, /CMS. And then below that, anybody can what they want, but we try and put some order in there. And then the SRM can be queried to return, because this URL here just is a handle to where the file is. But then when you want to do something with the file, you want to transfer it, you want to open it, you need to transport the file. Whatever you do, you need to transport. So the ID is to use a transport URL, not UTL, URL, which we call TURL. That is depending on what you want to do. So depending on the protocol you want to use, you can get a different TURL, because you may want to transfer, you may want to open the file. So SRM is in charge of providing you with this transport URL. And of course, it allows you to do some file management, like creating directories, deleting directories, listing directories. So it's a bit, it's not really POSIX-like, but it's somewhat like POSIX. You recognize here MKDIR, LS, RM, things like that, which is what you do normally on your machine. SRM is providing that, and then behind the scene is doing whatever is needed to handle the files. The applications, as I said, they use a transport URL in order to access the files, to transfer them or to open them. And it was decided that even on top of this standard interface, there would be even a simpler interface that would be put in place that is POSIX-like, that looks very much like a file system. So provides exactly the standard commands: open, read, write, seek, find, whatever. Everything that is provided by a normal file system is provided by this layer that we call gfile, and that knows about SRM. So gfile knows about SRM. It's able to get the TURL, and it's able to open the file for you. There is an alternative to the SRM plus gfile that you may hear of, and that is emerging in the past years. That is called XRootD. That is supposed to be at the same time a storage protocol and a transport protocol. And it has a big advantage that it's optimized for being used by root, which everybody uses to store data. So it knows exactly what is the pattern of access of root, and it's optimized for that. So it's something that might be extremely convenient to use in the future. But not all the sites are implementing XRootD yet, but Alice is pushing very much for it, and probably in the coming years this will be a de facto standard protocol that will be used. And whether gfile will still be of any use at the time, that we will see. But for the time being, gfile is still there. And then on top of that, there are even higher level tools that are provided that are called LCG utils based on gfile that give some really command line facilities to move the files, to replicate the files, and so on. So this is for the storage element and the access. Now for the file catalogs. As I said before, the files may have more than one copy. We call that in the jargon, we call that replicas. And we call the fact that a file is copied from here to there, we call that replication mechanism. And so these file catalogs are really useful because you can have an abstract logical representation of a file without knowing exactly where it is. And this we call a logical file name. And the structure of a logical file name is usually hierarchical, just like a path, slash CMS, slash something, slash blah, blah, slash blah. It's human readable, so it's not too problematic to understand what it is about, although it can be anything. It could be just a long string of characters that you don't understand. I give you an example that I took from the LCB catalog, or even I invented it. Sorry. So there is this logical file name that is very useful for a human being. But there is also another way to identify the files, and that we call a GUID. This is a unique identifier. It's a 128-bit bit string that is provided by a special library that is supposed to provide you uniqueness. Don't ask me how they do that, but they do that. They say that the probability that you get twice the same GUID is 10 to the minus 12 or something like this, so it's quite improbable. And whenever a file is created, a GUID is attributed to this file, and this is really the hardware identifier of the file. This is written inside the file even, and so that the file is really identified by this GUID. While the logical file name is human readable, you can imagine that 128 bits, even if you dump it in hexadecimal, it's a long string. So it's not readable, but this is the mechanism that is used if in a file you want to refer to data that is in another file, the reference is done using this GUID. So the file catalog has to contain this GUID to be able to identify which file one is talking about. So the file catalog is associating these GUIDs, the logical file names, and the list of replicas in the form of serves or in the form of X root D file names in case people use X root D like in Alice. And the queries that are made to the file catalog are essentially from a GUID, give me the list of replicas, or from this logical file name, give me the list of replicas. It also contains, like any catalog, some metadata like the size of the file, the date of creation, a few things like this. And in the LCG, as far as I know, there are three types of catalogs that are used. There is one called LFC, the LCG file catalog, that is used, that is developed in the framework of the LCG, of course, and that's used by Atlas and by LHCb. It's a database with a hierarchical structure of the file name, and it's quite generic. There is one that is similar, but was developed before by Alice, and it's part of their Alien grid access system. And in CMS, they use something called the trivial file catalog. It's just a convention on how to derive the name of the physical name of a file from its logical name. In fact, in LHCb, for example, I don't know in Atlas, but in LHCb, one could also do that. I mean, I know how to do it. LHCb who are experts know from a logical file name how to construct the physical file name. But sometimes it's a bit tough because sites change their conventions and then one has to change the rules. So for this reason, we prefer to keep it in the database. We feel it's safer. Anyway, you need a database to know what are the sites at which the data is replicated. So then we have these high-level data management tools that are integrating everything together. And of course, there are also the experiment frameworks that are integrating things together. But this is a simple example that I run on Alix Plus showing how this works. So the first command is a command on the file catalog, on the LFC. You just do an ls, so you list the file and you give the file name. So this is one of my file names, of my files. It's just a very small file, just for this the purpose of this example. And I verify that this file exists. It was created on the 16th of February. Blah blah blah. It has a size of 430 bytes, just for the sake of this. And then, well, this I just know this file exists. Then I have to know what are the replicas of this file and where are they. So I do LCG LR, list replicas of this LFN, and then you see that this is a CERN, SRM, column, blah, blah. So there is one replica at CERN of this file. And then I want to get a transport URL for this file, for the protocol RFIO, for example, for opening it in root. So I do an LCG GT, get a TURL from the CERN, and I get the term RFIO column slash slash castor LHCb .cern.ch blah blah blah. Then if instead of being able to open it with root, I want to transfer it using grid FTP, for example, I ask the same thing for the protocol GSI FTP and I get something that is completely different. Of course, the end is the same. There is always somewhere slash castor slash blah. But the beginning is different because this will not be used by RFIO, it will be used by grid FTP. And then there are other commands like LCG CP. This is copy, of course. I can copy this file to my local file system and call it test.root. And this just copies the file. So this is behind the scene. It's integrating gfile. It's integrating this one is integrating the file catalog. It has to interrogate the file catalog to get the information and so on. So you integrate all that in these high-level tools that can be either standard ones in LCG utils or it could be from the experiment framework. And you can go even further. You can go down to reading a file. So here I took a real DST file from LHCb. I get the list of replicas, and you see that in this specific case. There were three replicas, so LCGLR returns one at I2P3, one at CERN, and one at PIC in Spain. Then, since I was at CERN, I selected the one at CERN. I get a TURL for that one. I ask for the TURL using the root protocol. Then I get the transport URL here. Then I start root, and here I do tfile open. this, and then it's over. So in essentially three commands, which I integrate together, I can go from the logical file name. So I said that one needs also to transfer files. There is something like LCGCP that allows you to copy one file, but this is not very handy to be able to. If you have to copy 100,000 files to run 100,000 times LCGCP, that will take an awful lot of time. And also, you will not be able to schedule the transfers and so on. So in order to be able to do that, people have developed something called FTS, the file transfer system, which is doing some real handling and scheduling of the networks. And in particular, when transferring from CERN to the tier ones or between tier ones, it really uses dedicated physical paths that, in particular, the optical network that has been set up, the LHC OPN, so-called LHC OPN, that these are rented fibers connecting all the tier ones and the tier zero that are really rented by LCG and on which the bandwidth is guaranteed. And then the FTS, it's a unique service for transfer from A to B for a given channel. There is a unique service handling all the experiments and sharing the bandwidth. So for example, on a certain channel, it is decided that that Atlas and CMS will each have 35% of the bandwidth, and then Alice and LCB will share the rest, because we're always the small ones. And so 15% each, something like this. And then FTS is able, depending of course on the requests that are placed, is able to assign the file transfers to group them in order to use 35% of the bandwidth for Atlas for CMS, the rest for HCP analysis. So there is some optimization, and all the file transfers are grouped together, and they are done in bundles. They are done also using multiple streams and so on. So it's really an optimization of the network service that is really at the low level. And each FTS service, as I said, is handling a channel. So there are channels between all the sites, and there are now FTS channels even between some tier 2s, the largest tier 2s, and some tier 1s. Of course, not all the pairs are connected, but sometimes you have to go through one to go to the next one. But FTS is handling that as well. It optimizes very much the bandwidth, and it takes care of it takes care of some failures, and it retries the transfers in case something happens, like what happened last week, that there were some roadworks done in Spain, and they just might not. So, of course, all the file transfers fail. It's the second time in a month that this happens. It happened in Germany in July, and it happened last week in Spain. So I hope that there will be not too much roadwork when LHC is running. And something that was considered very useful at the time of the design of the system was what we call a file placement service. It's slightly different. File transfer service. You say, well, I would like these files to be copied from. So I want to copy this file to this file name to this file name. A placement service. You say, take this list of files, and I want all of them to be transferred to Rutherford Fermilab and ASGC, and do it. And I want you to go to the end. Each and every file has to be done, fully done, no intervention from human being. This was never implemented, but each experiment, of course, had to implement it themselves. And so now probably it will never be implemented as a standard service, because we already have it. So the other data management services, as I said, there is a metadata catalog. This is could hardly be designed as a generic thing, because it very much depends on how the VOs are characterizing the data sets. So there was an attempt to do something generic for that, to develop some piece of middleware, but this was finally abandoned, and each of the experiments have their own database for describing the metadata of their data sets. So for a few examples, so the information that is stored in there is the type of data, whether they are raw data, they are AODs, or whatever. The date of the data taking, the type of the simulated data, in case that it was a simulated Higgs or it was a simulated SUSY with these parameters and so on. The type of processing, in case for the real data it was reprocessed several times, then you can ask, I want the second reprocessing of 2011 and something like this, and then you get your data set. And as I said, it's far too specific to be really generic. Then, on top of all these tools are the VO frameworks. And these are really needed because the functionality that I described so far is rather basic. You have how to identify a file, how to put it in the file catalog, how to transfer it, but then you need to put the glue between all this. LCGUtils is putting some glue, but it's not enough. You also need to glue with the metadata catalog to put everything together, and this is the role of the experiment frameworks, the VO frameworks. So each of the LHC experiment has its own data management system that is integrating everything, the file catalog, the data set definition, for example, in LHCb, there is no notion of data set so far. There are just files. Everything boils down to files. While in Atlas and CMS, there is a notion of data sets, and people specify what they want to analyze in terms of the data set name. And then behind the scene, there is something that knows, of course, what are the files that are in this data set. And the data set is a block of files that is always traveling together, which poses a problem if you lose one of the files and the data set is not complete, and it might give some problem. You have to replace the file before the data set is complete again. This is one of the reasons why we have not yet implemented that in LHCb. Of course, the metadata catalog are integrated, and the access and transfer utilities like using FTS, grid FTP, and so on. So each experiment has its own high-level tool in CMS, for example, something called FedEx that is doing the file transfer. In Atlas, it's called, depending on the people, DDM or DQ2, Don Quixote 2, I think. And in LHCb, it's called Dirac, and in Alice, it's called Alien. But this is the high-level framework that each experiment is implementing, and I think this will not change. It's just based on the basic middleware. If the basic middleware changes, it's just the work of the central team to update it, but users don't have anything to change. And I think that with this, I come to exactly in time to the end of this first part of the lecture. Auditing is something that was never implemented. Yes, it's a good question. Well, yes. So before people are able to do something, they have to be authenticated, and then they have to be authorized. That's the a priori security system. Then they say that they wanted to do this or that, and then they are authorized to do it. But maybe they are going to do something different. You say I want to. You come to a border and you say I'm coming here for a conference, and then the first thing you do is to look for a job. Of course, you got the authorization to go for traveling or to go for a conference, but you didn't get the authorization to go and get a job, but nothing prevents you to ask for a job. So auditing is exactly checking a posteriori what people have done and whether what they have done was authorized. So it's one is a priori, the other one is a posteriori. And this was considered at the time of ADA as being something rather important to be able to find out misbehaving people, and as it is you can imagine, quite complex to set up. It was in fact never put in place.
How does this fit with the certificate application process that are
on? Well, that would after auditing is identifying someone that is misbehaving, then his certificate would be revoked. Well, this happens. Well, it's not really auditing, but it happens from time to time that people have their certificate temporarily revoked when their jobs are creating problems. And very often it's not malicious; it's nothing to do with the user himself or herself. But you can do it very easily. You submit a job using Root and doing some Rootfit and some toy Monte Carlo, producing a lot of events inside, and Root keeps everything in memory. And after a couple of minutes, your job is using 10 gigabytes of memory, and then the rest of the people they kill you because the machines become completely unusable. They can't even kill you because the machine is unreachable, because Linux is a very poor operating system. And usually what happens is that we get a mail and they say, this user is misbehaving. No, it's not misbehaving, it's just that he had not realized. But so far I've not heard of really misbehaving users. There were a few security issues from time to time, but to the point that we have to do some security exercises in order to verify that the sites are reacting properly. But the problem is, you say, well, next Wednesday I will do a fire alarm test. Then, of course, everybody is ready. But if it happens in the middle of the night of a weekend that somebody is really misbehaving, I'm not sure that the reaction would be the same.
It's
historical. Nobody remembers why this is the case. The first protocol that was available on Castor was RFIO, because this is an old protocol that was implemented, and so Root has a plugin for RFIO. And then the Root people said, well, this is not very handy for us because Root has a special pattern and so on. So they developed this Root protocol called RootD, not XRootD, RootD, which they developed. And for a reason nobody remembers, the protocol name in the TURL is not Root or RootD, but it's Castor. And so it's a bit strange because when if you look in the code of Root, it says if the protocol is Castor, then it calls the TRootD. It's like that. It's a convention.
So I think I